Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back to beautiful Pittsburgh. It's great to be here with you and having to spend some time listening to confessions. It's already clear that the fruits of the Spirit have been brought to bear here. It's a wonderful, wonderful time to spend with you. And I thought I was good at getting people guilt-ridden so they went to confession, but I can't touch Father Larry. After I listened to his talk, I was looking for any priest I could find quick. Just a few commercials as I begin. I continue to work in media, and just did the Huckabee Show recently on Fox, and found him to be a delightful guy. But also, if you have a radio, we're on Sirius Satellite Radio or the relevant radio stations, a show called Personally Speaking, and just did two, I think, pretty interesting interviews with people who ideologically are diametrically opposed to each other. But on the same day, I did Martin Sheen, the infinitely talented actor who's the father of Charlie Sheen. And he was great just to talk about the fact that as a father, he bears great responsibility for the mistakes that his son has made. And he talked about the fact that he was a rageaholic and an alcoholic when Charlie was growing up, and why he thinks so many of Charlie's present problems are related to him and his sin. As a dad, he didn't do what he should have done. And then there was Vice President Cheney on the same day. So Martin Sheen and Dick Cheney, and Cheney talking about how he had come to a different perspective on many issues, including the whole gay issue, because he found out that God had given him a daughter who was lesbian, and what that did to his perspective on our obligation to love our children always, no matter what. So it's been interesting, the radio thing, that's called Personally Speaking, and as I mentioned, it's on Sirius, as well as on all the relevant radio stations. And then I have a TV show called Close Encounter, and you don't have to watch it on TV, it's on PBS, but just go to closeencountertv.com. And some of our best interviews, I thought, were someone like Drew Brees talking about how God got him through the experience of the suicide of his mom. And just a wonderful opportunity. Frank Capra, the old film director, was a friend of mine when I was a kid. And he would say, if St. Paul lived now, he'd probably use the popular media as a way to reach the world. And I see TV and radio not just as an enemy, which sometimes they are, but also as an opportunity to get the message out. And if we don't go out there and try, we're missing a great opportunity. I love Cardinal Dolan, our new Archbishop of New York, because he knows that. You know, he's already been on the O'Reilly Show. He's gone into the lion's den, and he's been willing to speak about what he feels. He's got, by the way, if you haven't met Cardinal Dolan, one of the best gifts of all, self-deprecating wit. He spoke to us last week, and he said, you know, Cardinal Egan gave me a tour of St. Patrick's Cathedral, and he showed me everything. It was so exciting. He took me down to the crypt where all the great archbishops are buried, and he showed me his crypt. He said, this is when I die, where I will go. And I said to him, well, you know, now that I'm the Archbishop of New York, which crypt will be mine? And he looked at me and the size of me and said, you'll need several. He's a good man who knows it's important to remember to laugh. And the last commercials are radio, TV, and I'll be back by the book place with more of Life and Love. If you get a chance to hang out by the bookstore, I'll be back here after the talk. All right, we're talking about a bunch of things. One of the things we're talking about throughout this day is Eucharist and getting back in touch with the value of Eucharist, being embodiments of Christ, truly present. And I want to tell you, it's great to be in a place where we're talking about Eucharist in such a positive way, because I know for a lot of us, Eucharist was a thing of such awe, as it should be, that we sometimes forgot, though, the beauty of it as an occasion of happiness and joy. I remember, probably you do too, how seriously we were taught to treat the Eucharist. I mean, forget about receiving in the hand. You only receive in the mouth. I had Sister Ann Jeremy when I was in second grade, and we all have our nun stories, I'm sure. But she said, under no circumstance could you ever touch the host. So you start your life by having someone saying, don't you dare even think about touching the host. And then now we're in a church where we can obviously do that as Eucharistic ministers, as well as regular recipients. I remember when I was in second grade, kneeling there after communion, because you had to say that prayer that they wanted you to say right after you receive. And you know, back in the day, the Eucharist they used to give us was white and it was sticky. And it stuck to the roof of my mouth in that case. And I remember thinking, this thing isn't going to move. And Sister Ann Jeremy didn't seem to be anywhere around, so I took my finger. I'm in second grade, and I'm trying to pry Jesus loose. when from somewhere comes Sister Ann Jeremy behind me and swats me on the back of the head. By the way, releasing Jesus from the power of my mouth. God bless those nuns. I've always wanted to know where they could be now, these good sisters who taught us with their loving discipline from so many years ago. I want to suggest to you, too, that you have standing before you a guy who is infinitely human. I have been, since I saw you last year in Pittsburgh, stopped now 6 times by the police for my driving. Apparently, I have several gifts. One of them is not the ability to drive well. And I'm in New York recently, and I'm doing the thing you're not supposed to do, where I take the cell phone out and I'm talking while I'm driving. And sure enough, whoop, a police car comes up behind me, West End Avenue, Manhattan. And out steps a black policewoman, and I said, I am so fried. And by the way, I wasn't dressed this way. I was in regular civilian clothes, and she says, you know what you're doing wrong? I said, yeah, officer, I was on the cell phone. You know that's a $150 fine? Yes, officer. But happily for me, thank you, God, in the windshield I had a small clergy sign. So she says, what's that? I said, I'm clergy. What kind of clergy? Catholic. What kind of Catholic? I'm Monsignor Jim Lasanti. She says, well, Father, this is your lucky day. She says, because you just met one of 2 Catholic black policewomen on the force. This time, stay off the cell phone and listen, Father, for your penance, 3 Hail Marys. I said to her, for being so kind to me, officer, all your sins are forgiven. She says, I think it's been a good day for both of us. So I'm human and I'm sinful, and everything I'm going to talk about now, which is my topic, to talk openly and honestly about our church's teachings on human sexuality. I stand before you as a deeply imperfect man, as we all are, struggling as we all do. And anyone who thinks they come to a moment where they've got it all together, you know, where it's all going to make sense, where we're never going to be tempted, where our bodies are just going to be totally pure and chaste, we're fooling ourselves. Probably not till we're dead. It's kind of like the perfect family. You know, I go around the country to speak to different groups on family life, and I'll say, who comes from a perfect family here? And when people raise their hand, I said, I'll see you for confession right afterwards, you know? Because there's no such thing. No such thing as a perfect family. No such thing as a total sense of control over this powerful, wonderful gift, which is human sexual love. And let me start by saying, we have been, in some ways, I think, misguided in our approach to human sexuality. I think for a lot of us here, if you're my age or anywhere older than my age, you got to see it as something that was sinful and dirty and wrong, something nice people might do, but you don't talk about it. And I want to say right here and now, that's not what our church is saying. Our church is saying that sex is a beautiful, incredible gift from God, that it feels good because it is good, and it's a life-giving force. And we have got to begin by saying everything I've been taught, everything that made me feel neurotic guilt, everything that made me feel that sex is not something we can talk about openly and honestly is bogus, and rather that it's a beautiful gift, then we should be talking about it. That it's a precious gift from God that we're meant to speak about and to share with each other lovingly. What makes it holy? The church is very clear. Sex is holy when 2 forces are present. It has to be procreative, that is to say, open to the possibility of new life, and it has to be about the unity, that it is the bonding of 2 best friends, 2 soulmates, 2 people who are bound to each other by true commitment. The thing is, unitive means singular. You can't have multiple singular experiences. The whole idea is that it's unique to that particular person, that one person to whom I am completely committed, and I want to share it all with that person because she means that much to me. And that means for us, sharing it in the context of Christian marriage. What I'm saying to you is that sex is not bad. It's a good, wonderful, life-giving force, but it's meant to be shared in the right time, in the right place, with the right person. And as Catholic Christians, that means in the context of committed love, marriage. But I want to be so clear, I can't say it enough. If you have come from a background that taught you that sex was dirty and sinful and wrong, and you get all sorts of neurotic guilt if you think about anything sexual, cut it out! Because you're not where the church is, believe it or not. And by the way, I know that misunderstanding of sex very often came from the church. But then you have, thank God, the writings of John Paul II on the sacredness and the beauty of human sexual love. This celibate guy telling us what we need to hear about how precious human sexual love is. Now, I have a lot to do in a little time, and I hope you'll bear with me. We're going to fly through some of the church's teachings. Are you ready for this? We're going to try to do in the next half hour birth control, sterilization, homosexuality, masturbation, premarital sex, extramarital sex, pornography, abortion. Hold on to your seats, gentlemen. Here we go. All right, let's go to the birth control teaching. Church says you shouldn't be using artificial contraception. And what I'm going to suggest to you is let's go positive on this. Instead of seeing our church as a church of no, let's go with the yes. I don't know if you've even cracked a pamphlet on what natural family planning is. But what we tend to do with artificial contraception is somebody takes care of it. Either he's gonna use the condom or she's going to take the pill. It automatically, as soon as you give in to that, separates us out. We're not one team. The greatness of natural family planning is that we get to regulate when we're fertile and when we want to get pregnant, and when we're not fertile and when we can have all the sex we want without thinking about the idea of being pregnant. But more importantly, you can practice natural family planning, which, by the way, is not rhythm, which doesn't work, but is rather the symptothermic method or Billings ovulation method, methods that you work at because the two of you study her body and you learn as a team what works and what doesn't work. And it's not just honey that you take care of it, but we take care of it. We know when we're fertile, we know when we're not fertile. And every couple I know who is committed to natural family planning tells me the same thing. By the way, what do I know? I'm a priest, I'm not practicing it. But I listen to married people who are. And they tell me that it bonds them together in ways you'd never imagine. Because they're in it together completely. Now, what I'm saying to you is, look, you may have a long time ago decided we're going to go with the pill, we're going to go with something artificial. All I'm asking you to do is, the church says, inform your conscience. And that means know what the church teaches. And when the church teaches, hey, can you look at natural family planning? Can you call your diocese and get something to read, go to a class? If you're going to spend the rest of your life, please God, having sex with your partner, would you at least know what makes her body work? You know, this is interesting. In natural family planning, my diocese, they give a test on basically the biology of a woman. And most men, both during engaged period and early marriage, haven't got a clue. They have no idea how her body works, when she's fertile, how does she know she's fertile, when is she not fertile. Why wouldn't you want to know the fundamental chemistry and biology of this woman you love? Or more importantly, why are you letting her put, month after month, chemicals into her body, this woman you love? If you really love her and there's something natural that works, why not give it a try? What I'm saying is when you make a decision on whether or not to embrace the church's teaching, at least know what you're walking away from before you do. And I'm telling you again, from the couples who actually take seriously the teaching of the church and practice natural family planning, they say it always enhances not only their lovemaking, but also their relationship as husband and wife. The church is onto something here. It works, it's effective, it bonds couples closer together. Does it take a little more work than popping a pill? You bet. But is it worth it? They say that it is. Can you be open to that possibility? Sterilization, what's the problem with it? I've decided to play God. I've decided that I'm going to permanently sever any possibility that God wants to use me as an instrument for new life, but I don't want to be that instrument. So I say, not even open to the possibility. The procreative must be present. That's not to say every time I have sex, I'm going to have a kid. But every time I have sex, I'm open to the possibility that if it happens, I will not reject God's gift. But sterilization is me saying, you know what? I'm taking it out of God's hands. Now I'm playing God. I'm the one that's going to decide that we're not ever going to have any more children. Because I've decided that I have that role to play. It's not God's role, it's mine. Obviously, if you've taken that step, and I know there are plenty of guys here who have, then all you need to do, obviously, is to try your best to A, encourage other people not to embrace that way, and more importantly, if you have children, then dedicate yourselves monumentally to them and to their welfare as a sign of the fact, Lord, I may have taken a step of playing God, but just know, the children that you've already given me, I treasure them, I love them, and I will be there for them. Let's go on to something else we talk about sometimes, but not enough, which is homosexuality. The teaching of the church is pretty clear. We love the homosexual person. We don't love homosexual activity. There's a big difference, gentlemen, and we need to face that. I think sometimes we think, because our church is opposed to homosexuality, that I have a right to be biased or prejudiced against people who are gay, and you simply don't. The church is very clear. We are obligated to love all people, even those who are in any way different from you and me. And you know, one of the best things I think the church ever came out with a few years ago was a document called Always Our Children. It was basically saying to parents, okay, so you find out one day that your child is gay, what do you do about it? You love them. You love them, and then you love them some more. And one of the shows I did for PBS, we had a son and his mother, Jill and Jonathan Wood. And when Jonathan was about 24, he moved into New York City. His mom and dad, his dad was a football player with the New York Giants, Gary Wood, big macho guy. They went in to see Jonathan in his New York City apartment. They sat him down and they said, son, is there something about your life that you want to tell us? And he realized the jig was up and he said, you mean the fact that I'm gay? Yeah. Is that something you want to tell us, Jonathan? He said, well, mom and dad, I am. I didn't choose this. I wouldn't choose it. It's tough at so many levels. But I hope you can still love me, knowing that I am. And the father, Gary, the athlete, started to cry. And Jonathan said, Dad, I'm so sorry. I know this disappoints you, and I didn't mean to hurt you. Believe me, I didn't choose this. And his father said, I'm not crying because you're gay, Jonathan. I'm crying because for 24 years, you couldn't tell the people who love you the most in the world the truth about who you are. About 6 months later, Gary Wood had a heart attack and died, and Jonathan said on the program, I'm so glad my dad went to God, knowing who I really am. See, our kids have got to know that when we take them into our lives, we're doing it in an unconditional way. You know, it's easy to love conditionally. I'll love you if, I'll love you when, I'll love you but. I say very often at weddings, you're saying when you take that vow, I'm going to love you if we have $1 million in the bank. I'm going to love you if we can't make the next mortgage payment. I'm going to love you when you look stunning and beautiful as you probably do on your wedding day. I'm going to love you 30 years from now when you look like the back end of a truck. It's unconditional. Yeah, anybody can love conditionally. I love you if, I love you when, I love you what. To love unconditionally doesn't just apply to our wives and our husbands, it applies as well to our kids. And yes, they will break our hearts, and they'll disappoint us, and they'll let us down. Sorry, when you got the package, you came to say yes to everything. You accepted the gift from God to everything. And when you choose to have a child who's going to be gay, probably not. It's a special cross, it's a special burden for those kids. But don't add to their cross by being intolerant or bigoted or closed-minded or love them. And you can say, hey, I don't like the activity. I don't think I ever will. But I'm never, ever going to stop loving you. Our job is to separate out the activity from the person and always to love the person no matter what. And I know that runs contrary to what a lot of us, I think in some ways one of the last acceptable prejudices, certainly for a lot of people, is the ability to make fun of gay people, and it's not right, it's not Christian, it's not what Jesus would do. You know, you gotta go with the man. The man very clearly would love everybody. He did. And if you and I can, with clear face, say, I follow Jesus Christ, then I gotta do what he does. And would he say, oh, you're built differently than the rest of us, so I have the right to treat you with derision? No. He would love and love and then love again, even when she looks like the back end of the truck. Don't quote me to your wives, please don't. All right, I want to talk about masturbation. Go back to my opening comment about, for sex to be holy, it's got to have the unitive and appropriative. You don't score on that either way. You know, when you give it to masturbation, the procreative, no one's ever gotten pregnant by masturbating. And the unitive, it's not about sharing. Masturbation is about self-satisfaction. So you're missing the two elements that make sex holy. You're not sharing it with the person you love, and you're also not even open to the possibility of new life. Basically, masturbation is about pleasing me, myself, and I. That's it. So it's a fundamentally selfish act. I don't want guys, you know, getting into this breastfeeding thing and killing themselves because they masturbate. I think the reality is everybody goes through a period of this. And if you get into a habit where you can't stop, then you got almost a masturbatory addiction. You got to face that. But having said that, I think we've got to be kind to ourselves in this, you know? I love the language of illusion that we use. So very often people will say, well, you know, I want to confess impure thoughts. And they're wanting me to, you know, leave that alone. I say, what does that mean? You know, what is an impure thought? Well, you know, it leads to me doing something.
You're going to have to be more specific than that.
Well, you know, I play with myself. Well, it ain't playing. What are you talking about? I masturbate. Okay, why do you masturbate? Well, I'm lonely. Well, my wife and I aren't having relations. Then you know what? Work on the problem. Face the loneliness. Find other ways of having supportive relationships with the guys who are here today. In terms of the wife, you can't use the fact that she's cold to you as an excuse to give in to a masturbatory lifestyle. Because it's just going to take over your heart and your soul. It's not the way to go. Better still, you sit down with her and you need to, you get some counseling, and you try to rediscover what was once there. You once felt incredible passion for the woman you're married to. You can get it back. But you can only get it back if you try, by engaging her. Too many guys say to me, you know, we had a lot of fire in our relationship, but, you know, it's gone. No, it's never permanently gone. You know, when I'm counseling people in marriage counseling, I'll say to them, you know, inevitably, I'm going to raise the issue. I'll say, are you two still intimate? You still having sex? And when people say to me, we haven't had sex in 10 years, I want to say, hey, I took the celibacy vow. You didn't. You know? There's no reason we all have to suffer. I said to you last year what I'd say again. I would love it if you'd all go home today and say to your wives, we're going to have intimacy tonight. Monsignor told us that's our penance. I have to have sex with her.
Well, as Monsignor said.
All right, let's talk premarital and extramarital sex. You know what? They're the same animal. Here's the deal. Most couples, I told you this last year, in terms of the Joanne and Ray story, I told you about the couple who told me the other having sex, and I said, please don't before your wedding, you know, try to find non-general ways to express your love. But I know that the majority of kids coming into me to be married are already having sex. And if I press them on the point, I say, why do you think you have the right if you're not married to have sex? They say, look, you know, it's a nice day in our lives to get married, and, you know, the license makes us legal, but we love each other already, and love makes it okay. All right, let's hold on to that thought. Let's say that really all you need is, the Beatles said years ago, all you need is love. That love makes sex okay. Now let's say you get married, and it's 2 years down the line, you have a few kids, a lot of bills to pay, and you know, your wife doesn't quite look like she did on the wedding day, and you're under a lot of pressure, and you're looking for some form of release, and you find yourself with another girlfriend. You get involved with someone. So I say, well, what about your wife? And you say, hey, I love my wife, I love my kids, but, you know, I'm in love with this other chick, too. And I say to the couples who are engaged, would you ever accept that he is allowed to love two people, you and somebody else? And they say, no. Well, wait a second, he loves you, but he also loves his girlfriend. And you hear so all these wives-to-be say, no way, you can't love two people, it's either one or the other. Well, who said it? Let me tell you something, I fall in love all the time. And then I catch myself. Falling in love is easy. And if you say that sex before marriage is okay because I'm in love, then who's to say that you can't love more than one person? And so when your husband comes home and he's finally caught in saying, I love you as my wife and as the mother of my children, but I'm also in love with these other women, you can't say, no, 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 only one. No! The point is, what happens on the wedding day matters very much. It is an incredible, new, amazing commitment. And it says, I am committed to this person and this person alone. I think what we don't see the more we have sex before marriage is that we're undermining the very rationale we need to to try to avoid having multiple relationships outside of marriage once we're married. It's the same problem. Either I am committed and that commitment meant something, that sacramental bonding was uniquely and powerfully something that meant something, or not. But you can't have it both ways. Love makes it okay. Well, who says I'm only going to fall in love once? The reality is we will be attracted to and probably want others. You will definitely somewhere along the road of life say, yeah, my wife's nice, she's good, doesn't look the way she used to, it's a bit of a nag, pressures have gotten to us, we don't have the same close relationship we once had. Does that give you the legitimate right to find somebody else and to be unfaithful? And the answer is no. And gentlemen, it comes down to the golden rule again, as almost everything does. If it was on the opposite shoe, and you found out that she was cheating on you, would you ever find that acceptable? And you know the answer is no. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Unfaithfulness in marriage is unacceptable because it's heart-crushing to the person you do it to the mother of our children. And if you are sitting here today and you are in an extramarital relationship, I beg you, stop it. Yeah, but she really understands me like my wife doesn't. Cut it out. You're always going to find people out there who will be more attractive, more intelligent, more sensitive to you, more supportive, but that's not what you said. You said, I commit myself to you. Gentlemen, the words you said on your wedding day, I, John, take you, Mary, to be my wife. I promise to be true to you in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health. I will love you and honor you all the days of my life. Was your word any good? Because it didn't say, I'll love you if, or when, or but. I'll love you, period. The church is just saying, be faithful to your promise. You made the promise and live it. And if you're not married and you're sitting here today, think seriously about what legitimizes sexual activity. Because if you say, well, I'm in love with this girl and that's all I need to have sex, I'm telling you, you're setting yourself up for a fall. Because here's the surprise ending to the Beatles song. Love is not all you need. You need a whole lot more. Commitment, fidelity, a promise that is unbroken, a word that is honorable. These are the things we're called to live so as to avoid both premarital and extramarital sex. Pornography. Pornography. Okay, what's the matter with it? Very simply, let me be as rudimentary as I can be. You say it's a victimless crime. No, it's not. Let's say you put on the internet and you go to one of these porn sites. Only, surprise, surprise, you don't see naked strangers. You see there instead your daughter, your son, your granddaughter, your grandson. What do you feel? You know, and I know, you feel awful. Why? Because you love those people. Well, don't you get it? The people in pornography, the people on the internet, the people in those DVDs, they are someone's daughter, someone's son, someone's granddaughter, someone's grandson. And again, back to the golden rule, if you would not want that to be something that happens in your family, if you don't want to put on the computer and watch your granddaughter having sex with a stranger, why in the world would you pay to do that to somebody else's family? You know, we separate out and we compartmentalize. We stop seeing these people as people. They're just a piece of flesh that we're using for our personal satisfaction, but they're not. They're real people from real families who are worthy of respect and love, and when we give in to that, it is not victimless. We are taking human beings and making them a thing that exists for our own pleasure. And it's plain wrong. Say, well, yeah, but you know, I have all these reasons. I'm lonely, I'm horny, my wife is a stop. Come on. We know better. We know better. And if you can answer my question, and you answer my question no, then you've got your answer. Would you want to see anybody you love in those movies? And if your answer is no, of course not, then you know what? You have no business whatsoever in trying to exploit other people's families by watching that stuff. Let me tell you, too, because it's a related issue in terms of other people's families. You wouldn't want to see anybody you love exploited sexually. Well, then if there is any exploitation going on in your family, your job is to stop it. You ought to be the protector. You know, abuse of kids didn't just happen in the church. Those 4% of priests that do those horrible things, and I loathe what they did as much as you do, but it goes on in families as well. And just so I not fail to address the issue of abuse in the family, there is absolutely unacceptable tolerance for any kind of abuse. If you're part of it, you need to stop. If you know what's going on, you need to prevent it. You know, I have to tell you, in doing a lot of conferences around the country, I go to places where I get confession and I say to them, look, you're never going to see me again. So drop your heaviest duty sin on me. Open that little room in your soul where you've been hiding the most embarrassing sin you've got and release it. Let it experience the mercy of God. Show it in the light of His truth and be forgiven. And too often, I must tell you over the years, I'll hear a guy say, I'm a grandfather, I'm 80 years old, but 30, 40 years ago, I touched my grandchild in an inappropriate way. I've carried that guilt and that sorrow and that shame in me all these years. So I hope you'll take what Father Larry said seriously by opening up your heart and soul. And if that's part of your experience, either because you are a victim or a perpetrator, that you purge yourself of that today. There never is any acceptable reason whatsoever for abuse sexually of any kind. Okay, by the way, I want to say too that in talking about family life, which is always part and parcel of this, everybody's family, I said, isn't perfect, and that's certainly true. Not just on issues of sexual morality, but on everything. We're all imperfect. But the greatness of you being here today is in saying, I just want to try to get my life and my family better than we were. By the way, I come from a very imperfect family myself. I love them all, but I don't know if you guys have been through this at all. Inevitably, when you have children and grandchildren, sometimes religiously they can embrace what you embrace, but sometimes they're not. So I have two sisters. One, Patty, who's super Catholic and did everything by the church's lights. But I have another sister, Joan, who's a lawyer, which is probably a problem. Lives down in Virginia, and when she had her first child, you know, I was happy for them, I was delighted, but I eventually called a month or two and said, hey, Joan, let's get our calendars together, gotta baptize little Jonathan. And there was a long pause on the phone, and finally she admits to me, she said, well, my husband and I have been talking about it, and we don't see why we should force our religion on the child. You know, better he should grow up, and he can decide for himself. She's telling me this. So I said to him, Joan, you're going to let Jonathan decide if he wants to eat vegetables or go to school? No. Well, then you know what? You give to a kid what is valuable. You make the choice. That's what parents do. You give him faith because it will never hurt him. It will only be a good thing. Well, we don't believe that. You're going to have to respect that. Well, needless to say, it didn't go well. You know, we were very, very tense with each other. It was the elephant in the room. So I'm saying to you, all families have their problems. Anyway, about 2 or 3 months after Jonathan was born, I went down to Virginia with my sainted Irish Catholic mother. And by the way, speaking of confession, I promise I'll come back to Jonathan in a minute, but my mother's 91, and she's in a wheelchair. And recently, as I'm moving her to put her in bed at night, I'm getting her out of the wheelchair to put her in bed. She said, sit down for a minute. Okay, Mom, what is it? Before you go tonight, I want you to hear my confession. I said, Mom, not for nothing. You're 91, you're in a wheelchair. What sins could you possibly have? And she says with a glimmer in her eye, I wasn't always 91. Back to the kid out of Virginia. So I go to Virginia with my mother, and one day Joan says that she's short of groceries, she's got to go to the grocery store, but she really can't leave because of the baby, and my mother and I, as one voice, say, no, you go. So Joan gets in the car, she takes off to the grocery, and my mother has the baby in the kitchen. I said, Mom, give me Jonathan for a while. I'm going downstairs in the family room to watch TV with him. And she says, he's too young to watch TV. He's only 3 months old. Mom, give me the kid. She gives me the baby. I go downstairs to the family room, and I confess to you gentlemen, I did the deed. I baptized little Jonathan. Come back upstairs, and my mother, who's the sweetest lady in the world, looks at me very sternly, and she says, Jim, I'm going to ask you a question. Do not lie to me. What is it, Mom? Did you baptize that baby? I can't lie to you, Mom. I did. Well, that's good, she said. I wasn't sure if mine took. mother, she looks at me and says, "So did you do it?" Family life. None of us are perfect. None of us have it all together, but we do our best. What's my time? What's this time? What do I got? Beautiful. Good. We're doing great, guys. We've gotten through all human sexuality. Is it wonderful? No. Next one I want to get into, and this is always the one that's sensitive and stuff. What can we do about this thing called abortion? Why is the church so obsessed with it? Well, I'll tell you why. We believe it to be life. We believe it to be human life, not because the church says so, but because science says it, and we agree with science. This is one time when we're on the same wavelength. And the reality is, you and I are living in a country where every year about 1.25 million, sometimes as many as 1.5 million babies have died. We believe it's human life. And here's the troubling part of the thing, too, to me, is that the Alan Guttmacher Institute, which is the think tank for Planned Parenthood, they say in the New York Times that 98% of the abortions in this country are performed for what they call reasons of social convenience. 98% perform for reasons of social convenience. And what that means is it's not, you know, rape, incest, danger to the life of the mother. It's just that I don't want a baby right now. Or it's not convenient, or I'll be embarrassed because I'm not married, or because finances are hard. There are social reasons, and they are essentially, Guttmacher says, reasons of convenience. Now we gotta ask ourselves then, what does it mean about the culture? We are still, even with the Chinese out there, we are still the strongest, most powerful, richest, most blessed nation in the world. So why then do we eliminate over 1 million lives every year, especially when 98% of those are for reasons of social convenience? Doesn't make any sense. Doesn't seem to be right. What the church is saying is, we have a home for those babies. We don't need to kill them. Do you know, in America every year, because of infertility, 1 in 5 couples can't conceive a child. And there's probably plenty of reasons for that. But 1 in 5 couples can't conceive. So because of that, every year, there are 2 million applications for adoption. In our country, every year, 1 in 5 can't conceive. 2 million couples every year want to adopt a baby. Of that number, fewer than 50,000 will succeed. Why? Because we don't have babies. We abort them. In other words, if you have 1.2 million abortions every year, it means we have a home, we have a family, we have loving parents for every child conceived. So why don't we let the kids be born? You can't ever say, as the folks at Planned Parenthood will, well, you know, no one would want to bring into this world an unwanted child. I'm telling you, there's no such thing. We have the want, we just need the child. So, let's go over the facts again. 1.2 million abortions every year in the richest nation in the world. A country where 98% of those abortions are performed for reasons of social convenience. Does it make any sense? And 2 million couples every year out there who want to have a baby. So we have a home and a family for the kids. Now, let's go to the hard cases, okay? Because you hear and I hear, this is always what the other side likes to throw up. Well, what about the tough cases? Rape, incest, danger to the life of the mother. And I love when I'm dealing with some people who are not only pro-abortion, but they're also bigots. They say, how would you feel if a big black man raped your sister? I say, does it matter if he's black or not? You know, it's still the same crime, no matter what color the person is. So stop being a bigot on top of being a person who wants to terminate an innocent life. But let me talk to you about the special cases. It comes up to about 2% of the abortions every year. And the church says something that's a hard message to hear, but I gotta tell you, it says, in those cases, if there's somebody who should be punished, it's the father who rapes or commits incest. But why do we give capital punishment to the kid? We kill the kid for the crime of his father. And it doesn't make any sense. You know, I was speaking not that long ago at Great Neck High School, which in my neck of the woods is predominantly Jewish, very liberal area. And there had been an abortionist there the week before who told the kids, when the Monsignor comes, ask him this question, what about rape and incest? So they asked me the question. I told them what I just told you. The church says the baby didn't do anything wrong. Let the baby live. Place it for adoption. But don't kill the kid. It's not the kid's crime. It's the father's crime. Anyway, they took me apart for that answer. They were like booing me and treating me with disrespect. It was okay. I expected it. But then finally, girl raised her hand, maybe about 15, 16 years old. She said, she got up to the microphone, she said, "Now we all agree, right, that the priest is all wet when it comes to rape and incest, right? In that case, you should definitely have an abortion, right?" And the kids are all, "Yeah, yeah, yes, I got 1,000 kids cheering this woman on." She seems to be saying that we should abort kids who are conceived through rape or incest. And then when they quiet down, she says, "Well, everybody, I need to tell you something. 16 years ago, my mother went on a date. And I am the product of that date. I am the product of date rape. Now, who in this auditorium," she said, "wants to stand up and tell me it would be better if I had never been born?" I gotta tell you, you could hear a pin drop in that auditorium. And what she was onto was something we need to hear. That we talk about rape and incest as just words, but there's a child there. And the kid is innocent. I said to the girl afterwards, I said, "You know, I couldn't pay you to say that. That was like amazing." And she said, "Well, I just think it's so easy for people to dismiss us, but we're just kids. I didn't choose to be conceived by a rapist father, but I am, and I'm here. And I deserve the right to be born." So even in the hard cases, the church is saying, go after the bad guy, don't go after the kid. So what does the church say? We should allow all life to happen. All life. And I'm asking you guys to think seriously about where you stand on this, because this is kind of something that we all have to take a stand on. You know, we can't allow this to be one of those cases where we say, you know, it's too controversial. A lot of folks are closet pro-lifers, you know. I would never have one, but, you know, I don't want to interfere with anybody else's right to choose. Apply that to anything else. You know, would you ever say, if you want to shoot somebody, we look at this case in Florida, if you want to shoot that black kid, you know, I wouldn't do it, but it's your choice. We wouldn't say that. We'd say that's a lot of hogwash. That's a lot of hooey. The kid didn't have the right to shoot that kid, and no one has the right to destroy an innocent child in the womb. But somebody somewhere has got to say that. You know, I said when I was on Huckabee a couple of weeks ago, I said, you know, was on the whole healthcare thing, and I said, you know, I'm thinking the president on this issue is totally wrong. He just can't make us compromise our collective Catholic conscience on this. But I said, I want to be very clear. I am not an Obama hater, because a lot of people are just looking for another reason to hate him, and I refuse to do that. I admire and respect him, and I'm delighted we finally have an African American president. On that part, I'm okay with it. But I'll say, I got to tell him when he's wrong, that he's wrong. And we got to tell him that he's wrong on this issue. And to any politician of any party. You know, in New York, we had Governor Pataki and then Mayor Giuliani. They're wrong as rain, both of them on this issue. Republicans, Democrats, whoever they are. You know, I was so heartbroken before he became president, there was a bill in Illinois that said if a kid gets through the abortion alive, because some kids do, believe it or not, some kids actually survive an abortion. Not too many, but some. That in that case, the Illinois law said, the doctors should do what they can to save the child. In other words, it pops out of its mother before they manage to mangle and destroy it. You gotta let the kid live, right? It's born. One vote in the Illinois State Senate against that bill. What do you think? But Obama. How in the world does he say that a baby that got born doesn't have the right to live? Well, I don't think we do anybody any good by saying, any politician, "Well, you know, you're right on so many issues, you're just wrong on this one." I remember I had on the show years ago John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO, and I said, "You know, I know you're a good Catholic, so I know you think partial birth abortion is insane. Well, then how do you get into bed with Clinton and not say, oh, Mr. President, you might be right on human rights in many places, but on this right, you're wrong?" And I obviously made him very uncomfortable by asking the question. But you got to ask the question. To any politician at any level, you got to say, wait a second, I do believe, not as an issue of faith alone, but as an issue of science, I believe that kid is a kid and is worthy of protection. And when we go silent, I tell you, I see it, I'm reading all these books as you probably have about where was the church, where were the Bonhoeffers in the church during the period leading up to the Holocaust. Like, we didn't know they were carting all our Jewish neighbors away, we said and did nothing. Most people went along to get along. And I think with abortion, we got the same issue. We know what it is. I love the language of illusion that we use, you know? When you want it, you find out you're pregnant, a woman doesn't say, "Oh my God, I just came back from the doctor, I'm expecting a fetus." You don't say that. We're going to have a baby. But as soon as you don't want it, it's the fetus. Right? The language of illusion. We try to mask it. We call it a choice. Woman's body, woman's right. No. It's not just her body. Now there's another body in there too. With another heart, another soul, another brain. You know, I've had my disagreements with Vice President Cheney, but I said to him, I said, look, you play the conservative most of the time as the Vice President, but here's the deal. On one issue, you're very liberal, on gay rights, on gay marriage. How come? He said, well, I see it as a libertarian issue that we shouldn't tell people what to do with their own personal lives. If my daughter chooses to get married, I think she has the right to do that, he said. Obviously disagreed, but the point is, I had to ask the follow-up question. Well, if you really believe that personal autonomy is the basis for giving gay people the right to marry, then let me play devil's advocate. Why then do you oppose a woman's right to have control over her own body, Mr. Vice President? And he said something that was on target. He said, Monsignor, if my daughter gets married, it's a decision she makes for her. If my daughter is pregnant, there's another human life in there, and she has no right to kill that life. And what he was saying is on target. Abortion is an entirely unique, frightening issue. And I ask you in good conscience, not only to study what the church says, but to stand by the church in saying, I will someday stand before my God. And I hope he will say to me, well done, good and faithful servant. Because those who could not speak for themselves, you were willing to speak for. The unborn, the preborn, the voiceless ones, the most defenseless members of society. You were willing to do that. But silence always aids the oppressor, never the oppressed. And our silence kills. I'm going to close with one final story, I promise, and then I'm going to move on. You know, everything you say about church ethics and teaching on sex, while I believe it's the truth, I have to also tell you that I think the biggest mistake we make as a church is righteousness and a sense of judgmental quality, you know. And I want to say everything I've said to you today, whether it's about masturbation, birth control, abortion, whatever. You have the truth in the church, and I believe you do. But if it's a truth that's taught without gentleness and love and compassion, then it's an empty truth. I love the fact that Jesus could sit down with people who were major sinners and talk to them always with love. So I'm saying to you, it's not enough that our church has these teachings on sexual ethics. When people fail, as we all do, when they're imperfect, as we all are, our job is to love them always and forever, no matter what. Everything I said to you about sexual ethics has to be taught in the context of, let's try our best, knowing that we'll probably fail sometimes. And this is where I close with the final story. I mentioned my younger sister, Patty, who I love and adore. We're very close. Anyway, she got married. I did the wedding. Wonderful guy, a doctor. And they had a bumpy first year marriage. And by the end of the first year of marriage, we weren't sure the marriage was going to last. And then, to complicate things, she found out she was pregnant. And her husband is a good man. He's a very practical man. And he said, look, we're not ready for a baby. You know? Maybe later on, we solve all the problems. We always have kids later on. But right now, you've got to terminate that baby. We have to work on us first. Now, you might think it's not even an issue. You know, good Catholic family, the brothers, the priests, and all that stuff. No, it wasn't that way at all. As Patty said to us as a family, I still love this man. I want to be married to him. I don't want to be divorced. I remember her saying, you know, some women have the strength to be single parents who raise their kids alone. I don't. I can't do it. I don't want to do this, but I have to do it. I have to get rid of this pregnancy for now so that I can save my marriage. You can imagine as a family what this did to us. We went back and forth fighting and debating. And I remember one night in particular, we were in my parents' dining room. And I remember Patty said, after listening to all of our arguments, I understand what you're saying, I respect what you're saying, but I have to make my choice. And this was on a Saturday. Sunday, she was going to go with her husband, Monday, to have the abortion. And I remember what I did that night. When all arguments failed, I stood up and I looked at my sister right in the eyes and I said, Patty, if you have this abortion, then it's not only the baby that dies, you are dead to us too. She broke into tears and she ran out of the door. Dead to us too. Just before she got out the door, my mom was there. She said, Patty, stop. I hate what you are about to do. That's my grandchild. I want that child to be born. But Patty, when I accepted you in my life, I accepted you as you are, not as how I hoped you would be. So if you have this terrible thing that you do, just know you will always be welcome in my home, and I will always love you. Your brother spoke for himself. He didn't speak for me and Daddy. Patty left Monday morning, went to the abortion clinic, was on the table, about to have that baby aborted, when from somewhere, and I have to believe it was the grace of God, she found the courage to say to the doctor, "Stop. I don't want to do this. My husband wants me to do it." She went out into the waiting room. Her husband said, "If you don't go through with this, we are finished." And she said, "Well, then I guess we're done." She came home to my parents and lived with us, lived to have the baby. When Matthew, we named him Matthew, when Matthew was born, I didn't want her to go through childbirth alone, and her husband was gone by then. So I took the Lamaze classes, you know, and I was the Lamaze coach when the baby was born. Guys, so many of you gone through that. The best thing in the world is to see this kid be born. Although, I have to tell you, it's a scary thing. Thank God we're men, huh? You know, it's an amazing thing. Dr. Levine delivered, and Dr. Levine didn't know that I wasn't the husband, I was the brother, so I'm in civilian clothes down by the head of my sister, and he's the way he helps women to relax is he's very off color, you know? Terrible mouth on him, and Rose Giambola, the head nurse, she knows this is Monsignor Lasanti. So she says, "Doctor, can I see him outside for a minute, please?" And I hear from outside the door, Oh! I said to Rose later on, "What did you say to him?" I said, "That's not her husband. Oh, that's her brother. Oh, a Roman Catholic Monsignor. Oh!" Here's the final point of what I'm trying to say. Long after Matthew had been born, and I love that kid so much, I said to Patty, I took her out to lunch one day, and I said, "I gotta know, where did you find the courage on that table in an abortion clinic to get up and to have that baby? Where did you get the courage, the strength to do that?" And she said, "Well, I certainly didn't get it from you." She said, "When I needed compassion and understanding, kindness, just a little kindness, you gave me hatred, condemnation, and a heart that was stony. But Mommy, who believes everything that you do about the sacredness of life, had enough heart to say, 'I hate what you're doing, but I will always love you, and you will always be welcome in my home.' I got the strength, Jim, to do the right thing because she remembered to love us unconditionally. We have beautiful teachings, but they mean nothing unless they're delivered with love. Jesus is at the well with that woman who has five husbands, and she's living with a guy she's not married to. He still sits there and he talks to her and he loves her. You and I follow him. How in the name of God do I follow him and condemn my own sister to death?" I was wrong. And I'm trying to say that these teachings, beautiful as they are, mean nothing unless they are delivered and lived always, in every circumstance, with an unconditional, gentle, and merciful love. We have great truth. Our truth is more powerful by the way in which we deliver it and live it in love. Thank you for listening.